Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, August 31st. This morning, we hear from Honolulu City Council Chair Tommy Waters following the Friday decision by the Hawaii Supreme Court that ruled him ineligible to run again. He joins us live. What's the fix to make sure this doesn't happen again in another election cycle? Some say it's not fair to voters, not fair to candidates. We hear more about the fears of our healthcare community as HMSA, the largest health insurer, makes changes that kick in tomorrow. We're also just learning about electric shock gloves, a new tool that ICE agents will be able to use in their raids, what lawmakers are saying about the news. And a Maui-based motivational speaker teaches us a new card game. It's called Three Things. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, Honolulu City Council Chair Tommy Waters joins us live in the studio. On Friday, the Hawaii Supreme Court ruled that he is ineligible to run in the general election. That means the other two top vote-getters, Trevor Ozawa and Tara Malia Gregory, will advance to the general in November. HPR reached out to both of those candidates after the ruling. Here's what they had to say.
I want to say something about Tommy Waters. He reached out to me today and wished me well. And I really appreciated that. I responded and told him that if elected, my door is always going to be open to him and his supporters, no matter who they voted for. All the constituents in the district will be welcome if I get the opportunity to serve as the council member for East Honolulu.
I'm feeling very grateful. I was in the courtroom that day. I was able to defend myself pro se, so I am grateful for that opportunity. And I'm not shocked with the courtroom and the Supreme Court's decision. I'm not even shocked that they were split, because there is a lot of ambiguity inside of 3-102, right? It's great that these things do happen. Because we want to make sure that things are very clear for constituents, so and for candidates, so we know what we're working with, what we're dealing with, and we take heed of this. And hopefully this is a precedent that's set, that we get that charter language squared away.
And there you have it, reaction from two of the candidates. And we have Council Chair Tommy Waters in studio this morning. Tommy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Aloha. Good morning. Nice to be here.
Yeah. And full disclosure, you represent the district that I live in. But, you know, I think people are just wondering how you're doing. You know, I mean, this was, I'm sure, a blow to you. So, yeah.
Well, I'm fine. It was more shocking when Ashford, the circuit court judge, ruled against us. That was a big surprise. But, you know, ultimately, it was a vague, not clear, ambiguous issue. And it's great that we got some closure. And, you know, the Supreme Court ruled 3-2, which still tells you something, right? It wasn't a unanimous decision. So two justices sided with me and three justices were on the other side.
You know, so you had the weekend to kind of decompress. Any thoughts about, you know, what you might do?
Well, first, may I just thank the voters and supporters and the whole district, for that matter, for allowing me to represent them for the last 6+ years. You know, it really was an honor. It's a large district. It runs all the way from Makapu Point all the way to Waikiki. It used to be all the way to Alamona Shopping Center, and they redistricted it. But, you know, I've been getting so many calls and texts from supporters and just strangers at the shopping center saying, hey, you know, thank you so much for your service. We appreciate you. You did a good job. And that felt really, really good, I have to tell you. You know, it made it a lot easier to accept this verdict.
Well, you know, I was wondering, for the voters that voted early and was when this monkey wrench got thrown in the process, you know, I wondered, you know, how they were feeling, right? And then also, I talked to someone in the district who said that she voted for you anyway, knowing that this cloud was hanging overhead, just because, whether it was protest, but, I don't know. So, I'm sure you've had people come up and tell you that.
Oh, people were angry. They were darn right angry. And I got it. You know, interestingly, the circuit court set the hearing like a month down the line, knowing that the ballots were already going to be printed and mailed, which added to the confusion, honestly. It would have been nicer if we could have gotten a hearing way in advance. And that way we wouldn't be in this situation, right? But it is what it is. I think ultimately, though, the Supreme Court did rule on Hawaii Vice Statutes 12-8 that you have to take care of these types of disputes 60 days prior to the primary election. That way we won't have the same problem. That's why, this situation was very unique. I think it won't happen again. At least that's my opinion, that it was just a really, really unique situation where in 2018, ballots were collected after the close of the polls, and the Supreme Court ruled that was improper and ordered a new election. But the way the timeline was, the new election didn't occur until April of the following year. So my first term, I actually missed the whole budget process, right? There was an interim council member, Mike Formby, who later became the managing director. He was appointed by the council to be the council member for District 4 for 4 or 5 months. So it was a very unique situation that I'm not sure will ever, ever happen again.
Well, and I think that's one thing that people were worried about. Well, what's the fix? If the language is ambiguous, how do we fix it? Does the Charter Commission fix it? Is there something that needs to be initiated by the Honolulu City Council? Or do state lawmakers get involved? But certainly, with so many votes hanging like that and, the candidates, being affected, you want to clear this up.
Yeah, I do think the Supreme Court ultimately did draw a bright line. And they said, if you're elected to a 4-year term, it doesn't matter when you were served. It's when you were elected or what you were elected to a 4-year term, which is really, again, it's probably never going to happen again. But if someone were to serve, say, 2 years out of the 4-year term under this current ruling, that counts as a 4-year term. My case was a little close, right? It was 3 years, 7 months, but it still wasn't a 4-year term. Me being an attorney myself, I asked that question like, hey, does this count as a 4-year term? Does 4 years mean actually 4 years? And the Supreme Court said, yeah, if you get elected to a 4-year term, doesn't matter when you get elected. That's the term. So,
I recall reading an article, and I think in there you were quoted when someone asked, are they going to let you run? And I think at the time you might have said you didn't know. So I do have to wonder, is there anything that you could have done for clarification earlier on? I think of that line, right? It's better to ask forgiveness after than permission in advance. But I don't know,
Yeah. Well, under the law, you would have a preliminary determination by the court, not the court clerk, the city clerk. And then if you are deemed ineligible, then the candidate can take it to circuit court for a final ruling. But it doesn't say the opposite, right? If you are eligible, what then? Right? So, we had someone from our campaign file something with the clerk just to figure it out whether or not I'm eligible or not. And the clerk said, yeah, you're eligible. So based on that, we actually spent quite a bit of money. We put up yard signs. We had radio. We even did TV. My mail program was up and running, only to, be challenged at circuit court and the judge to say, nope, you're ineligible now.
Well, the fact that the city clerk, you're essentially the city clerk's boss, right? And so there's some folks that are like, oh, that's kind of a little weird.
Yeah, I can see why people would say that. But I was hands off, and I let him do his job. And ultimately, I think ultimately, based on the ruling, right, where the Supreme Court dismissed Trevor's lawsuit, which sort of supports what the clerk said all along. But yeah, the other thing was interesting about this case was the dissent. In the dissent, they said, well, when it's vague like this, you should let the voters decide. And that's kind of what I was banking on. Although, like I said, this is a unique issue. Other jurisdictions had somewhat similar situations where it was vague and the other jurisdictions let the voters decide. Would have been interesting, though, if we really did go and I was on the ballot. I thought maybe the fairest thing would just do a rerun, have all four candidates on the ballot. That way nobody was disenfranchised at all, and then winner take all.
I did put a call into the state elections officer, Scott Nago, you know, wondering about, is there any way to determine how many people might have filed and voted for you after, you know, that first decision came down, just in protest? And he thought that there were people, you know, and he said, well, you know, maybe you could look at the third printout, because everything from the first printout was everything ahead of time. But I just was wondering if there was something more on date that would provide some kind of glimpse into what voters were thinking.
Oh, that's interesting, because I know 10,000 people voted before the decision. So, yeah, I would be really interested to see how many have voted for me prior to
if there's any way to
decision.
Track that back.
Yeah.
You know, you have a few more months yet on the council. Is there anything that you want to tackle and get squared away before you leave office?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Disaster preparedness, you know, with the Kona low and this last storm and another one coming, the city really needs to be more better prepared. And part of that is socking away money for infrastructure. That's one of the things I'd like to try to do between now and then. You know, there's this transit accommodation tax that we use to build rail. But there's a lot of it that we could that's not used for rail that we could set aside for disaster preparedness, right? It was really bad with our electricity going out and possibly water in certain areas. So that's one thing I'd like to try to do. You know, sewer fees are going to be doubled in the next couple of years. And I had a plan on how to lower your sewer fees, which I'm happy to share with Trevor. That was really nice of him to say that he's still willing to work with me on these issues. The city has to site a new landfill. That is still up in the air. Is it going to go on the east side in my district, which is one of the places that is not over an aquifer, Cocoa Head Crater? That's on the short list. You got Kailua on the short list, and of course on the west side. But that's a big deal. We got to figure out what are we going to do with our solid waste, you know? Of course, housing is another huge issue for all of us. You know, I've told you this story before. I'm the fifth of six kids. We're all born and raised right here in Honolulu. I went to Kamehameha schools along with one of my brothers and sisters. Two of my sisters went to Castle. One of my sisters went to Kaiser High School, but they all live on the mainland. They can't afford to live here. And I'm deathly afraid that my kids are going to go away to college and get a good job and not come back because it's too expensive. So housing is a huge, huge deal. And I know whoever's elected is going to take that serious as well.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask you, I know one issue that was a contention was eliminating the funding for the mayor's economic development office. What was the thinking? Why did you feel that had to happen?
Well, there's a scathing audit that came out about the Office of Economic Recovery. And we were simply asking that how was the mayor as well as the department going to address those concerns? And we really didn't get a satisfactory answer on how they're going to address it. They talked about a strategic plan, but we didn't get that till after the mayor let everybody go. And by the way, we didn't eliminate the department. I just want to be as clear as possible. The director, the deputy director, the film office, and a couple community liaisons were still funded. The mayor made the decision to not fund those positions or fill those positions. So he let Amy Asselbay go, the director. We didn't do that. That was actually a decision that the mayor made. And I was hoping, actually, that we could come back next year with the administration telling us how they're going to do better. And then we could go from there and possibly refund these positions. But, yeah, that's what happened.
Okay. Well, I guess that will be something for your replacement to deal with as we come up. But, yeah, thank you so much, Council Chair Tommy Waters, for being here today and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you. Time is up already?
Time is up.
Bye, really fast. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, we have been hearing from Honolulu City Council Chair Tommy Waters about his disqualification as we head into the general election.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001.
When politicians talk about America's working class, they often mean blue-collar workers without college degrees. But should we expand that definition?
People are feeling more and more like their work is not getting them dignity and a high quality of life. The way that some people are reacting to it is to say, well, I am working class.
I'm Emery Sievertson, America's new working class. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, after the world.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, serving the Hawaii Island community since 1916, supporting Kupuna Wellness in its TV show Seniors Living in Paradise. KTASuperstores.com.
The Honolulu Star Advertiser's lead story in the Sunday edition highlighted a change in the healthcare landscape that kicks in tomorrow, September 1st. Reporter Nina Wood joins us to talk about the latest development as there are talks between HMSA and Hawaii Pacific Health to team up under a new healthcare model.
If you do remember, there was a big switch earlier where people who are on value-based model, where you get paid per patient per month, they want everybody to switch, all the providers, that is, the doctors and providers, to switch back to fee-for-service, where you get paid per patient seen or per service rendered. And so that's a huge switch, and they were originally just given 2 months to do that, and it would have been effective back in July. But, you know, due to some intervention by the governor and some others, they agreed to extend that to January. But meanwhile, these new policies are in effect come Tuesday, and they will affect, doctors and providers, because as a result of it, many of the patients will be dropped from their panels. In other words, for the provider, they won't be covered in that per patient per month model. And so that's what has some people, you know, some of these providers really alarmed, because for some, such as Kaleo Correa, she's at Waimea Primary Care. She has been given numbers that number over 400. So that's a huge, huge drop.
And the concern is that obviously these smaller businesses, entities, will shut down.
Yes, definitely independent providers, providers in the neighbor islands, they will feel that hit more financially. There is, unfortunately, one in Hilo Family Medicine. Now, they sent a letter to their patients just saying that, you know, due to some changes by, you know, a large insurer, that it would be difficult for them to continue operationally. And they had been in business for 27 years in Hilo. So those two doctors have informed their patients that they are shutting at the end of September. And so, of course, anytime you lose a clinic or you lose another place closes, patients are already struggling to get appointments with, you know, a primary care doctor, and I can only imagine this can make it worse. Now, those two will go to Hilo Benioff Medical Center and end up being there, but then the patients have to transfer there to be seen by those doctors. So, yeah, it's a shakeup in a way. At least that's the way Kaleo Correo put it, a shakeup, yes.
And there's no reprieve like they got with the fee-for-service program.
No, I don't believe there's any reprieve. Now, HMSA is, you know, they want to switch everybody back to fee-for-service. Now, as part of their transformation, they are offering neighbor island practices a 15% differential, meaning they will give them 15% more. But I think a lot of the folks that have embraced the value-based model, they had, you know, embraced it, built their businesses around it. So, of course, to switch back to fee-for-service is a very difficult, you know, process for them. And to do it in 60 days would have been just almost challenging, impossible. But now they're being hit by some, you know, another policy in September where, you know, they're literally going to get a financial hit with patients being dropped just come September. So it's what the policy is. And I forgot to explain the second policy change. The second policy change is that if one of the patients has seen you as a PCP, but they've also seen another doctor, which I don't know, might be a PCP or not, then whichever doctor saw that patient most, they will be the ones that get the monthly per month payment. The doctor that saw them maybe less, they won't get any reimbursement at all. So this kind of makes it confusing, and there's been some questions of what exactly is a PCP? What if you saw somebody for diabetes, they were a diabetes specialist or something, and what if you saw them four times and then you only went to your PCP three times? Well, then that diabetes doctor would be getting the payment and not you, and that's a loss for someone who saw a patient three times.
And yeah, your story talks about how HMSA says, look, we're just trying to get our arms around our costs, right?
Yes. Now, they say this is all about just, you know, having more accurate data, more accurate claims data, and just being more accurate about all of it, and that they need to have a better database, that this is kind of also what the federal government is asking for, even though that's, you know, not, these are not necessarily federally covered patients. These are some patients that are on commercial plans, but they just want to better capture their data. And the other confusion, though, is that HMSA had announced earlier this year that they do plan to partner up with Hawaii Pacific Health, which is one of our largest hospital systems. Now, when, you know, they were presenting this to the public and to various stakeholders, they had said, oh, we really, really, you know, we embrace the value-based model, the per patient, per month model. That's what we embrace. So I think there's a sort of like, what is this flip-flop going on? Why are we switching? Why is HMSA switching the fee-for-service? And then, you know, then, but if this merger, if this partnership is approved by federal regulators, then it's, sounds as if they are embracing the value-based model. Well, and there's many theories, but, you know.
Yeah, we'll have to see how this plays out. But thank you so much for bringing it up to the forefront.
Thank you. Thank you.
We have been talking to Nina Wu. You can read her story at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from Homeworks Construction, a full-service design-build general contractor committed to working with homeowners to design and build homes with the future in mind. HomeworksHawaii.com.
On the next Fresh Air, why do Americans spend so much time waiting? On hold? In waiting rooms? Filling out paperwork? Journalist Annie Lowry calls it the time tax, and she says the difficulty is often the point. She talks about who designed the system, who profits when you give up, and what it would take to get our time back. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, after On Point.
I'm Bert Lum. Next time on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll talk to Colin Rinesmith, who literally wrote the book on digital equity ecosystems. We'll learn how geographically diverse communities form coalitions to help close the digital divide. That's next time on Bite Marks Cafe, Friday at 6:30 p.m.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
The news that the Trump administration plans to pay more than $16 million to buy something called shock gloves for its immigration enforcement agents has raised some eyebrows. HPR's Cassie Ordonio joins us live this morning with more on what she's hearing. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, I think we're all familiar with stun guns, but shock gloves, that's a new one for me.
Yeah, but they've actually been around for quite some time now. In recent years, law enforcement officers has been using these gloves in correctional facilities and jails and whatnot. So they've been around for quite some time, but you know, the Department of Homeland Security, they recently awarded on late Friday, a contract with the Kentucky-based company called Compliant Technologies to buy the glove. And that's an acronym that stands for Generated Low Output Voltage Emitter. And these gloves, it kind of looks like normal patrol gloves until an officer presses a button and to activate this electrical mode. But the shock has to make contact with someone's skin. So when I was looking at videos on Compliant Technologies YouTube video, it doesn't really shock you through your clothes, or if an officer is holding on to a person's skin while using the glove, they don't get shocked as well. Or another officer holding on to the detainee on another arm doesn't get shocked, but it's only to that detainee. But the company described this glove as a conductive distraction and de-escalation device. But Hawaii lawmakers, immigration attorneys and advocates have been raising concerns about their potential use. They called it unnecessary and cruel. And when I spoke to Jill Takuda, she told me that she and other members of Congress were unaware of this planned purchase and thought ICE was trying to circumvent lawmakers. And she added that Congress was in recess when DHS announced its plans to buy thousands of gloves for its ICE officers.
They were well aware we were in August recess. For many individuals in the middle of potential primary election season, a lot of things going on in our communities. For us, we were literally preparing for a hurricane coming our way when the memo was coming out. All that to say that they are intentionally trying to be deceptive. They're intentionally trying to fast track this process to get these gloves and to put them into the hands of ICE agents. This is where all of us must be absolutely vigilant. As soon as we get back to DC, if someone's not already crafting legislation, I would guess they're already crafting legislation to outright ban the use of these kinds of gloves and weapons. I'm sure there's going to be a bill introduced very shortly. I will sign on to them.
Yeah, and so Congress did send a letter to DHS last week, but you know, it kind of 2 days later, then they approved the contract. So it's happening very fast. And these gloves could be in the hands of ICE officers by March of next year. So I was trying to answer the question in my reporting, are these gloves coming to Hawaii? ICE didn't respond to my questions of whether the gloves will be deployed in Hawaii and how many ICE officers will get. But DHS did email me saying that ICE is evaluating new tools and equipment for the officers and that any technology must comply with its use of force policies. But reading the policies is still kind of unclear how these trainings are going to work for these ICE agents when or if they get these gloves. But earlier I said these gloves aren't new. In recent years, the electric shock gloves have already been used by officers in jails and police departments, and critics have pointed to the dangers of these devices, and they pointed to the death of a 43-year-old man in Kentucky who died after allegedly being shocked 40 times by officers with a combination of the electric gloves and a taser. And so gloves are also being used in other states like Texas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma. And for other lawmakers, you know, states like California, they're already fast tracking a measure to ban ICE from using electric shock gloves in Hawaii. But Hawaii Senator Carl Rhodes, who's retiring this year, said the gloves could be a topic for state lawmakers next year, although the legislature did adjourn in May, months before DHS announced its planned purchase. And Rhodes said that his concern isn't about the technology itself. It's how federal immigration officers might use it.
I think they're just cartoonishly evil. And I'm not sure anybody, I'm not aware of any other police force, at least in Hawaii, that uses them. I don't think any of the counties use them. I don't think the FBI uses them. I'm quite sure the sheriffs don't use them. And what are they for? I think the answer to what they're for fairly clearly is just, it's all part of this thuggish image that they like to project. You know, we're operating anonymously. We can grab you off the street and arrest you. We don't have to ask you whether you're a U.S. citizen. We're just going to take you off the street and throw you in prison somewhere, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Some advocates I spoke to, like the timing, they said the timing was very interesting because the Hawaii State Legislature runs from January to May, and then the announcement came months after. So these gloves are supposed to be in the hands of ICE officers by March of next year. That would be in the middle of the legislative session for Hawaii. So that's kind of something that lawmakers are going to have to talk about. But like Rhodes was saying, that he hasn't heard of any officers here or sheriffs that use electric shock gloves other than carrying just the regular basic firearms and tasers. What's interesting about when I was looking at those gloves online is that these gloves don't leave a mark, unlike tasers do. And that's very concerning for immigration rights attorney like Leilani Stacy, who works at ACLU Hawaii. And she said these devices could be problematic, and she expressed concerns over excessive force and the lack of justification for using the devices on nonviolent people. And she also raised concerns about the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and that protects against unreasonable searches and seizures, but it also has been cited in uses of excessive force.
I think what's especially concerning here is kind of that severity of the crime at issue prong, if you will, because most of the enforcement that immigration enforcement officials are conducting right now, so most of the conduct that ICE is engaging in right now is targeting folks who really only have civil immigration compliance issues. So they haven't necessarily committed any crime, right? We know that a majority of people who are being locked up right now have committed no crime, or maybe they have minor infractions. But these are really just, you know, working people day in, day out, our neighbors, our coworkers in the community. And the assumption almost is that these people are somehow dangerous to ICE officials, when we've seen the opposite to be true. We know that ICE officials have killed citizens and non-citizens in the past country in these kinds of interactions. And just giving ICE officials another tool in their belt to use that can cause serious harm is really alarming for a number of reasons.
So whether these gloves are coming to Hawaii or not, it has caused a lot of alarm in the immigrant advocates community and the immigrant community. A lot of them didn't even know about these gloves other than like what they've seen this month, actually. I mean, DHS posted that notice in early August, and now August 28th, that's when they approved the contract for compliant technologies. You know, when I spoke to Liza Ryan Gill, who's an immigrant advocate, she's concerned about how much ICE training ICE officers will get. She also said her organization will be meeting with immigrant communities in October and November to inform them of their rights.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if the shock is more than a stun gun, and then what happens if, you know, several officers are detaining somebody, and you know, then you've got voltage from three different people. You know, so yeah, lots of questions being raised about the use of these things. So we'll see how this all plays out.
Exactly.
Yeah, and see how we respond to this. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from Cassie Ordonio. You can follow her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
HPR is hiring a donor relations officer. The role involves building meaningful relationships with donors and supporting measurable fundraising goals. The position works collaboratively to advance HPR's major and planned giving efforts, to help strengthen donor engagement, and to support the station's long-term financial sustainability. For more information, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
HPR is your source for music with culture. Every Sunday, we give you the recipe for a flavorful afternoon and evening. Start off with Kanikapila Sunday at 2 p.m.
Hello, everyone. And welcome to Kanikapila Sunday from Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Keali Iloma.
Mix in some Hawaii Kula Iwi at 6.
Aloha mai kako ke ho'olohene oko ya Hawaii Kula Iwi ma Hawaii Public Radio 1. Ovono ke yo DJ Mermaid.
Then add a little spice from the Brazilian Experience at 7.
Olá minha gente, bem-vindos à Brazilian Experience. Sou eu, Sandy Tsukiyama, com vocês. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Brazilian Experience.
HPR is your favorite hotspot, serving up the music that feeds your day. Let's keep moving forward together. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the Global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
Three Things. It's a card game and brainchild of Maui-based motivational speaker Eric Saperston, and it's out now. But really, it's about creating a human connection between players by asking them to share three things that they've learned about a variety of topics, and apparently it's fun, too. HPR's Kevin Allen sat down and spoke with Saperston about his extraordinary life, and he starts us off with one of his favorite quotes.
To know the road ahead, ask those coming back. And that spoke to me, and I realized that if I wanted to live an extraordinary life, the quickest and surest way for me to do that would be to go seek out some of the most extraordinary people in the world and take them out for a cup of coffee and find out the values they live by, the struggles they've endured, and what advice and counsel they would give to me and others to better prepare ourselves for the road ahead. And I had no idea if anybody would say yes to me. I just figured that that would be a way that I can increase my odds of being successful. So out of desperation, really, I set off on this adventure to bridge a gap between young people and elders, elders of proven depth and character and young people that want to learn. And it certainly didn't happen right away. I bought a Volkswagen bus. I took my golden retriever, Jack, and we set off across America. And I don't know if you've ever pulled into rest areas before. Maybe you've seen me and not remembered. Because how I funded my trip is I would sell off my Coleman stove. I would sell sexy, kind grilled cheese sandwiches made with love for $1. And that's how I funded my dream of calling up the most powerful people in the world and taking them out for coffee. And people would look at me like I was absolutely crazy. I would get no's. lots of no's, and I would just be tenacious as I possibly could be. And so I started to get access to some pretty extraordinary people. I met with the director of the FBI, the founder of Home Depot, the chairman of UPS. I've met with Sir Richard Branson, Woody Harrelson, Kathy Thornton, the first woman astronaut in space, all these incredible people.
And the journey has taken you so far. And that was back in 1995. Now, 31 years later, you're making a card game, kind of similar and kind of about creating more conversations, but you want other people to converse. And it's called Three Things. What does that mean?
Ah, good. Well, three things, exactly that. So we live in an era now where technology can answer almost anything, but it cannot tell you what grandma learned after being married for 50 years or what your best friend discovered after rebuilding after failure or what your daughter dreams of becoming. Those answers still live inside of people. And for centuries, communities and families gathered not just to share information, they shared lessons, they celebrated milestones, and they helped one another navigate life. And I realized after meeting all these extraordinary people that being extraordinary isn't reserved for just a few. It's available to all of us. And that this card game, Three Things, gives us an opportunity to bring back one of the most honored traditions, which is gathering and passing along what we have learned on our journey and helping others navigate theirs.
And why just three things? Why not 10 things or five things? Why is three the magic number?
The magic, well, there's a song, right? Three is the magic number, right?
That, it's true. Yeah, shocks,
so
right?
That's pretty much so. The reason why three, it's incredible that we stumbled upon this. I'm a filmmaker. I made it, that journey that I took turned into an award-winning film that we sold at Sundance, and it won South by Southwest and played in theaters across the country. And so I've spent my career interviewing all kinds of people. And I love interviewing people. And there was a moment there where I realized that I wanted to figure out how to synthesize what somebody had learned. I wanted to give them a formula where they could access and distill the best parts of a lesson. And then I realized that if I ask somebody a question, hey, what's one thing you learned about leadership? People will kind of wander on for a while. If I ask, what are three things you've learned about leadership? Now that person has to distill that information into three parts. Experts have proven that our brain processes and recalls best in threes, and that it's easier to remember when somebody shares a three. That's why many people start a speech by, here are the three things, or we know that, or we have a red, white, and blue, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We remember things in threes. The second thing about three is that it shapes the very way we communicate. Every great story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So by sharing three things instead of two or instead of 10, it helps people become better storytellers. And that's always awesome because this game enables people to really come across smart because they're distilling three things and it categorizes it in a way that everybody's like, wow, that was incredible. And the third thing about three things is that especially in regards to our card game, is that if I ask somebody a question, what are three things that you've learned being on a team? Well, the first answer can come kind of quickly. We all kind of have that one carrying it in our back pocket. The second one takes a moment to just conjure up. And the third one, that's the magic sauce behind three things, because that third one shows up and it surprises not only the listeners, but the speaker as well. And it connects the head and the heart together very quickly.
You know, it's very meta of you to answer my question with three answers. And the third one was, in fact, the most profound. That really caught me off guard there.
If anything, I am on brand.
Incredibly so. And I would say that we are strangers, and the game is about strangers becoming friends through conversation, or it can lead to that. Do you happen to have any cards with you right now that you could show us, or we could try to do a round right here? Oh, you are incredibly on brand.
Right here, buddy.
You're showing it to us right now.
You got it. Let's see. So the card, what we like to say is three things is a question and answer game that turns strangers into friends and friends into family. And these 52 cards help you get to know people better while discovering everyone has something extraordinary to contribute. All right. And then here we go. We're going to go ahead. I'm just going to fan these out for you. And, you're going to pick one. Ready? You just tell me which one.
That one.
Perfect. All right. This one says, this is for you, my friend. What are three things you've learned about getting into trouble?
Oh, it's hard to get out of. It's easy to get into. And that when I do get into trouble, the first thing I think about is the people I'll let down, I guess. Wow, you made me connect with myself there in a way that I was not expecting. It's also weird to be asked a question in your own interview.
It's so fun, right? It's so
fun. Can I pick one for you? Can you do that again? And then
you sure can. You're going to pick one for me.
I'll pick one for you. We'll go right there.
Well, let's see. This one, can you read that?
I can. What are three things you have learned about courage?
Three things I've learned about courage. Number one, I met Richard Branson and spent a week with him. I got invited to speak on his island to 60 world leaders. And Richard said that the brave may not live forever, but the cautious do not live at all. And I think there's something about being brave is very courageous. It's about just being able to risk. It's being able to trust your instincts and without knowing how it's going to turn out, but just trust your instincts anyway. So that's number one. Number two thing I've learned about courage is that it is such a big factor in living an extraordinary life. If a person doesn't have courage, it's very difficult to live an extraordinary life. Being courageous, being willing to act, be your word, do what you say you're going to do, make things happen, speak your possibility into the world, all those things take courage. And the third thing that I've learned about courage, the word courage has the word rage in it. And I think that there's something in there for me, that I think that in order to go do something courageous, it's channeling that rage energy into a positive modality.
If this was a competitive card game, I feel like your answer might have beat mine.
That's a good. We call it a game, although it's not really a game technically. But we like to say that the only way to lose this game is not to play.
And, you know, I think you've been living in Hawaii for some time now. And I find that's kind of an interesting aspect to this all, too. I think in Hawaii, maybe it's a cultural thing or it's just how we're brought up. But a lot of people are like very open to sharing. You know, they're open to talking story, right? Having these conversations. Why do you think this game would be, I guess, a hit in particular for people living here in the islands who are already so comfortable, you know, just talking story, hanging out, you know?
That's exactly it. I mean, the living here and, yeah, this is such, but I'm so grateful to live here in Hawaii. It's my favorite place on earth. I get to travel all around and go give speeches to, you know, all these different companies, and then I always get to come home. It's the most wondrous place. People are amazing. The culture is amazing. And yeah, what you just said, that talk story is such a powerful idea to me. And I love that, you know, I live out, you know, in the most remote part of the island, and, you know, two cars will stop and there'll be seven cars backed up, but it won't matter because, you know, auntie and uncle are catching up with each other on the, you know, backside of Hana here. And it just is what it is. And I love that idea that people will stop and talk to one another.
And, you know, just kind of wrapping things up, the game's been out for a little bit now. You've seen people play it. What is it like kind of watching people go through their own journeys of playing three things and creating these conversations just from, I guess, your perspective, the one who, you know, kind of made the game, made it come together? Is it like just as you thought it would be, or like what was that like, and how do you see people change or interact, or, you know, what is that
synergy? Oh, I love it. Like? Yeah, the game has exceeded our expectations for sure. It was an idea that would enable people to come together and exchange wisdom. And we wanted it to be funny, which it is. And we wanted it to be insightful, which it is. And it builds bridges. It connects generations. It's been very fascinating to watch strangers who don't know each other all of a sudden within a round have a deeper sense of who people are. We've been told that some of the people that we know that are single ladies play the game with their suitors, so that they could figure out where they're coming from as a litmus test to see if they're, right, you know, their quality. We've seen it where families do it. We've seen it where organizations use it to kick off a meeting. One of the things that we hear often is after people play the game or hear somebody give an answer, even if they've known them for years, they'll say, "Oh, I never knew that about you." And that is the true thing. And it's we feel like we've captured lightning in a bottle. Everybody has lived experiences. Extraordinary is not just for a few people. All of us, you know, all of us have lived extraordinary lives, whether we're a single parent or whether we're working as a school teacher or a farmer. We don't have to be famous to be extraordinary. Extraordinary to me is operating on all cylinders and just living your best life. And every single person that we meet can answer all these questions. They're universally gettable. And we've watched it where seven-year-olds all of a sudden answer what are three things they've learned about motivation and leave everybody speechless. And we've listened to 90-year-olds talk about what they've learned about gratitude. And it's phenomenal to have everybody share what they've learned. And if you find people fascinating, you'll love this game.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Eric, for sitting down with us today. And we really appreciate you.
Oh, my pleasure. What a treat. And I hope our paths cross again soon, my friend.
That was HPR's Kevin Allen and motivational speaker Eric Zapperston. He created the game Three Things. And if you'd like to try it out for yourself, find out more details on where to get it at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us for now. We're out of time. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about a rapid response team reaching out to industries which employ many immigrants. What to do when ICE comes calling. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast. Head to Spotify or Apple or check our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.